I could tell that Mrs. Cobb was not pleased. My fourth grade teacher with the wig that always flopped when she talked to me. After all, she had assigned us the task of writing about our favorite hero. Now, I think the problem was that she was expecting something totally different. After all, it was 1974, and I was one of the first students to integrate Mayport Elementary School. So I imagine that she thought this smart, Navy brat with the socially aware and active parents who would have no doubt given her a great education in the proud history of African Americans would have probably picked one of those African Americans for her heroine or hero profile. Now, when I really think about it, with that expectation, it might not be so hard to understand why Ms. Cobb found my profile of a 30-something white man who wore tights and a feather boa a little disturbing. Nature boy Ric Flair was, in many ways, my hero. He's the 21-time world heavyweight wrestling champion. He is the only wrestler to be inducted into the Hall of Fame of the Wrestling Association for both individual and outstanding work in a team, the Four Horsemen. More than that bleach blonde individual that many of you like, Hulk Hogan, no one ever personified the beauty and, dare I say, the grace that is professional wrestling like Ric Flair. Before you ask, yes, I do have his autograph. I have every videotape of every match, whether held in the continental US or in Japan. I know every one of his signature moves, including the one that I perfected on an unsuspecting baby sister called the belly-to-back suplex. Besides, perhaps, his signature, woo! Flair is known for the motto by which he wrestled. Whether he was the champion or the challenger, Ric Flair would look into the camera and say, "You've got to put on those tights, you've got to walk down that aisle, and you've got to be the man to beat the man." It was a mantra that he repeated throughout his entire career. Now, throughout his notable career that has spanned over four decades and continues even today, Flair has been on both sides of the river of success. He has known what it's like to be the champion. He has also known what it's like to be sued by his promoters. Accusations of dirty dealing and underhanded behavior have followed him throughout his career. He's had four marriages, several bankruptcies. By 2001, he was really a shell of his former self. He had made a mess of his life, even by his own admissions. In his biography, which I own, he summed it up like this, and I'm paraphrasing. He said, these were not things I'd only heard once or twice. I'd heard them for years, and after a while, they had begun to broke me. I felt like I was losing the essential Ric Flair strut, and in many ways, my joy for life. I began to wonder if I would have a legacy at all. He said, I started confessing to people who had watched me at the pinnacle of my career, watched me trade half chops with Wahoo McDaniel, or take Dusty Rhodes' bionic elbow, or hang out with my cohorts, the Four Horsemen. I just had to confess to them that the Nature Boy wasn't the Nature Boy anymore. He said, but it was not until I was standing in the middle of the ring, nearly broken, nearly battered, I finally realized with tears streaming down my eyes that really to be the man, you've got to beat the man. I'd said it so many times when I looked at the camera, taunting my opponents as I shoved my title in the camera. Well, I realized that night in Greenville, South Carolina, I had finally beaten the one who had held me back. I finally had beaten myself. And now I could wear the crown. Now I was all those things I was supposed to be. I was Slick Rick, Space Mountain, Secretariat in disguise. A kiss stealing, wheeling, dealing, jet flying, limousine riding, son of a gun. To be my best, I finally had to, as Ric Flair said, I had to wrestle me. Jacob came into this world wrestling. From the time he was conceived, when he was in the womb, he was wrestling his brother Esau. When he came out of the womb, he only did so holding on to the heel of his brother Esau. Over time, Jacob would wrestle his brother's birthright away from him with a bowl of stew. He would wrestle his brother's blessing away from him through deception. Even after he met the trickiest trickster of them all, his father-in-law Laban, Jacob found a way to even wrestle a sizable fortune of cattle and goats and servants away from him. Now, Jacob's style was what we call in wrestling circles catches, catch can. Now, it's a little different from Greco-Roman wrestling. Greco-Roman wrestling is what you do in the Olympics where you face your opponent, it's honorable, you see everything that's coming. And catch as catch can, it's okay to poke them in the eyes, throw sand in their eyes, hit them with a chair, throw a brick at them, whatever it takes. Because catch as catch can, the goal was all about winning at all costs, about taking advantage of your opponent's weakness. Consequently, Jacob, like Ric Flair, was just one world-class sneaky son of a gun. Interestingly enough, despite being named Jacob, which literally means in Hebrew, the heel, this cunning dude was the one that God wanted to fulfill the promise to Abraham through. Now hear me. A guy known for cheating, a guy whose nickname is the heel, would be the heir and fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham, the promise to make his descendants a great nation. God promised him, even as Jacob was on the run from his brother, that he would be given a land that would one day be all of his and his descendants. Yet, despite the fact that Jacob was a kid of promise, despite the fact that Jason was a kid of divine appointment, having heard God's promises and proclamations of a bountiful future, Jacob couldn't stop trying to wrestle the blessings and riches of others away for himself. He couldn't stop playing favorites. He couldn't stop trying to fool his wives. He couldn't stop being fooled by his father-in-law. Simply put, Jacob's life was one big web of deception, and he couldn't stop being a heel. Even when he wanted to start over, even when he said, okay, let's get a fresh new start, his wives learned from him how to steal, and they stole things from their father as they snuck out of the camp. And when the father-in-law caught up with him and finally accused him of theft, Jacob, rather than owning up to his sin, went after Laban, recounting all the evil that Laban had done to him with the veracity of a victim, and none of the humility of a perpetrator. And though he is able to make a sneaky kind of truce with Laban, he had to recognize that his most difficult obstacle was going to come. That in order to get to the promised land, Jacob would have to face the one obstacle he really didn't want to face. He was going to have to face the one that he had deceived first. He was going to have to face the one that he had cheated the most. He was going to have to see his very first victim, his brother Esau. So when Jacob heard that his brother Esau was on his way to meet him, not with his family, but with 400 men, which in the text means warriors, Jacob knew that a time of reckoning was upon him. Jacob, fearing the worst, tried the only thing he had in his repertoire. He tried more manipulation and sneakiness. What's interesting is that the first entity that Jacob chooses to try to manipulate is God. Listen to this prayer that Jacob gives. O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good. Oh, I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you've shown to your servant, For with only my staff I crossed the Jordan, and now I am big enough to become two companies. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I'm afraid of him. He may come and kill us all, the mothers of the children, too. Yet you've said, I surely will do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number. Wow, what a prayer. To the casual observer, his prayer seems sincere. It seems heartfelt. It seems perfectly appropriate. But for those of us who know the rest of the story, like Paul Harvey would say, what we know is that this was Jacob's best effort to con God. See, let's keep in mind that the reason why that Jacob only had a staff when he first crossed the Jordan was because he had just ripped off his brother, and his brother was chasing him, and he didn't have time to get the rest of his stuff together. That he had engaged in such a cycle of cheat the cheater with his father-in-law that he had gained all the stuff that he was able to cross back over with. And so it makes Jacob's prayer rather self-serving. So rather than saying, Lord, I've wronged my brother and I need to face the consequences, Jacob attempts to manipulate God with God's own words. Sort of Jacob was saying this, you know, God, you promised me that I was going to inherit all this stuff, so it doesn't really work for you if Esau kills me. Because you said that you were going to let me inherit the world. You were going to make my descendants as plentiful as the grains of sand. So therefore, Lord, you can't really let me have what I deserve, because if you do, your promises are null and void. After finishing his prayer, Jacob sends his family ahead of him. And he tries to butter up his brother by sending his brother some gifts way ahead. And so, alone in a desolate place, Jacob is where we find him at this point in the text. But instead of getting a good night's sleep, the text says that he wrestled a man all night long. We don't know who this masked wrestler was or when he arrived, but what we do know is that after hour, minute after minute, hold after hold, Jacob was forced to engage. Jacob was forced to give and get got. Jacob was forced to face someone head on and not behind their back. Jacob was forced to face himself. The text records that the battle was a standstill in which Jacob held his own. It was only when the wrestler touched his hip that Jacob began to lose an advantage. Now, Jacob, being a heel grabber, wasn't about to let go without a blessing. The question we have to ask our friends, what was Jacob's blessing? Now, most scholars would say, well, it's, of course, his new name. But I think it was something more than that. I think it was a new life. I believe that Jacob's blessing was that he had learned not to dwell beneath. You see, I think Jacob had become so used to being a bottom dweller, so used to being a human catfish of the lake of life, that he learned how to thrive there. He learned how to get into the gutter and win. He learned the art of cutting short, the backbite, the side swindle. He learned the art of dirty dealing, and he was good at it. The divine wrestler who wrestled with Jacob that day caught Jacob the heel and forced him to stand upright, to no longer be a bottom dweller, to engage the world in his full self, not over in his bent over, compromising self. The fact that his hip was touched and he was forced to walk with a limp meant that Jacob couldn't sneak in anybody's tent and he couldn't sneak out of town anymore. It meant that he had to face the world as a straight-up guy. Jacob the Hill got a new name, having faced himself and the ultimate wrestler. Jacob the Hill became someone new. Jacob the heel became better than he had been. Jacob the heel became the man that he was called to be. Jacob the heel finally became the head of a great nation. Friends, Jacob's story is a story that's very human. It's a story that you and I live. It is the story that says that you and I will never be able to enter into the rest of God until we are willing to face ourselves. Until we are ready, not in defiance, not in deception, but in the real, low-down, not-so-pretty truth of ourselves, deal with what and who we are. Not with just what's been done to us, but we have to admit the stuff we've done to other people. We can't cross over to the other side. We can't reach the wonderful destinations that God has for us. We cannot and will not find the rest of God, that wonderful rest that we're able to have when we worship God in spirit and in truth, until we deal with the truth of who we are. Now, don't get me wrong, Jacob was a very successful heel. He had land, he had goats, he had family. But for a successful guy, Jacob was always afraid. He was always afraid of the next deal that wouldn't happen. He was always afraid of the guy who he had swindled coming back on him. Jacob was always a victimizer, always bending over to the lowest common denominator of who he was. He was a mere shadow of who he was called to be. He was fearful that one day a deal would go bad. He was afraid that one day he would get his just deserts. Too often, friends, we fool ourselves into thinking that our achievements will come through our own abilities, that our successes will be made through the right access to the right people, the right meetings, the right friends. That our success will come through our willingness to compromise, to obfuscate, to twist the truth into the gaps of ambiguity and the gray spaces that are not in the contract. Some of us are so addicted to the game, to the con, that we only have a passing acquaintance with the truth of who we are. Friends, truthful living doesn't come by the art of the deal. I don't care what my good friend Donald Trump may say. Truthful living doesn't come from the access to the right club. It doesn't come from having the house on the right street. It doesn't come with getting the right degree from the right place. It doesn't come from having a certain amount of money in the bank. Truthful living does not happen when you turn a blind eye to injustice or cruelty for political expediency. Truthful living doesn't happen when you have an indifferent heart to the pain and the oppression of others, even if they don't live in your same country. Truthful living cannot be the voice that proclaims self-righteousness or self-promotion, or donning a mask that we don in order to comply with the expectations of a world that only seeks to dim our God light rather than help them shine. True success, true living of the self comes when, like my hero Ric Flair says, that we put on our tights of reality, we walk down the aisle of salvation, we get into the ring of grace, and we face the most fearsome opponent we'll ever face, which is ourselves. But yet, like Jacob, we will not be alone in our hours of truth, friends. Cheering us on will be our greatest fan, our toughest critic, our most fearsome coach, or better known as our most gracious Lord. A Lord who is ready to help us stand up and face the world, not in catch-as-catch-can, but in honor and integrity, in the grace and the truth in which we were created. Amen.